Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. Today, we'll be talking to author and activist and former Ohio Democratic Party chair, David Pepper. We're going to talk about his new book, which is a hand guide to what ordinary people can and should do to defend American democracy at the state and local levels. This is where so much crazy shit happens every day with way too little exposure to sunlight. It's also where you can have an outsized impact, right? You can go and knock on some doors in a presidential contest. That is great. Should do that. But getting involved in local races is where you can really make your punch felt. Anyway, first, Ron DeSantis' presidential rollout, as you know by now, went swimmingly, like everything else on Elon Musk's Twitter. All of the top headlines as we record today on Thursday are about the glitch-filled, kind of incomprehensible announcement and associated disinformation with DeSantis' rollout, thanks to Elon Musk. With Elon Musk and Wingnut hedge fund dude who's an ally of Musk's. By the way, DeSantis also released a very weird introductory campaign ad that featured Elon Musk as much as it showed DeSantis. It was just like this weird montage of shots of like DeSantis looking heroic and then Elon Musk randomly. And I wonder if that was like, I guess there's a collaboration between their teams. It's risky to put any kind of weight on Musk as a political candidate because he can just, you know, switch allegiances on a dime. Of course, the technical issues with the Twitter Spaces, whatever the broadcast, were embarrassing for Musk. After he fired 90% of Twitter's employees and bragged about how his keen management skills would right that ship. Right-wing Musk fans are saying that the glitches are a sign of how much demand there is for DeSantis. It's DeSantis-mentum. But on Thursday, several outlets reported that the audience was, A, not that big, certainly not bigger than some other like classic Twitter moments that didn't crash the site, and also that Musk and his skeleton crew did nothing to prepare for a surge in users, you know, after advertising this big rollout, which just goes to show yet again that if your daddy has an emerald mine and you have a knack for self-promotion and a lack of ethics, then you too can be called a super genius despite very little evidence of that. As far as DeSantis' campaign goes, it's a very minor glitch that doesn't matter much, or it would be a very minor glitch that doesn't matter much. You know, it's one of those things. I think the shambolic rollout is getting more attention than it might because it fits a pattern that is coming to define DeSantis early on, right? I mean, this guy, if you pay close attention to politics, obviously you know this guy very well. But if you don't, you know, he's the governor of Florida. He's only been around making national news for a couple of years. And so he's just becoming defined for some people, and he's getting this kind of the aura has been pierced, and people are starting to see him, pundits and the like, as kind of a Bush League candidate who is extremely popular in Florida, right, with its vast expanse of wingnut boomers, but just not really ready for prime time. And I'll say here, just to let the record show that I've always thought that DeSantis is a mediocre, shitty politician with no charisma whatsoever. I've always thought that he did not have a great chance on a national stage. When you get into the spotlight, people start looking closely. And I think what happened to make him seem for a while there like a less ridiculous than Trump juggernaut of the right was that he appealed to conservative media types, pundits, and a lot of the big money guys, although several of them have recently been rethinking that. And so they boosted him up in the hope of like ridding themselves of Trump's drama. You have this divide between the I hesitate to say establishment because they're all MAGA-like, but yeah, the money guys, the media guys, and the base. The base obviously is full on for Trump. So they boosted him up in the hope of, you know, of disentangling the party from Trump. And then the legacy media, which is always eager to cover a normal center-right party, even though that does not exist at present in America, kind of followed their lead. And they also hyped him up relentlessly. But there was nothing really ever there. Now, the bigger knock on DeSantis' announcement, which I did not bother to watch because why the hell would I do that to myself? And by the way, that means Elon can't blame me for overwhelming the servers. The bigger knock on DeSantis' announcement is that his whole pitch was the kind of stuff that like very online right wingers care about and ordinary people have just never heard about. So he, for example, he talked about DEI, right? Without defining that. It stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. All things like wingnuts hate. But he didn't define it. He just started talking about DEI. And he used terms like ESGs. So that's an investment strategy that looks at a company's environmental and social impacts. He talked about the narrative. Like what narrative? Normal people, you know, do not know what the narrative is. He talked about debanking and the like. Like a lot of like really just insidery stuff. And we've talked about this before on the show. People like DeSantis and his team are so stuck in the right-wing media bubble that they can't even relate to normies anymore. They can't even talk about things that people care about. And, you know, it was interesting because at the end, he kind of like, this is again, according to reports, at the end, he kind of realized, oh, I better mention like crime and immigration and all the usual Republican talking points. He almost forgot about them until the end. Now, of course, we have no idea how the next year or so will play out. We know Trump is scheduled to have a criminal trial in Manhattan next March on all those felony charges related to paying to kill off embarrassing stories in 2016, Stormy Daniels and others. We don't know if special counsel Jack Goldsmith or Fulton County DA Fannie Willis will charge Trump. Or how all of that will play out. And that uncertainty is one reason why you have all these people who seem to have no chance jumping into the race, like Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, that little tech bro weirdo, what's his name? Ramaswamy. It's the uncertainty. If Trump becomes too much dead weight or the drama becomes too much for his cultists or the establishment convinces the base that he's unelectable, then DeSantis would ostensibly be the nominee, but DeSantis actually sucks and he's being exposed and he's short and he's weird. And maybe the Republican establishment could pull him across the finish line if that scenario plays out, but they might also be looking for a fresh face. Like a Tim Scott type, who knows? And then as a fallback, they can always try to be a vice presidential nominee. Anyway, I have violated my rule this week about not covering the 2024 race until there is one. I will take this moment to remind you to ignore all of the polls and all of the punditry until around Thanksgiving when voters start tuning in. Between now and then, yeah, there's the invisible primary going on where party elites kind of put forth their preferences and everybody jockeys for a position with funders and the like. But, you know, it'll actually get going after Thanksgiving. In the meantime, we're going to take a little bit of a closer look, at what's going on closer to home, further down the ballot with David Pepper. We'll do that right after this break. Stay tuned. And we are back. Folks, regular listeners know that we always try to strike a balance here between warning you about how bad our political situation has become as one of our two major parties has embraced a really belligerent brand of authoritarianism, and offering some hope that things will get better. We want you to be alarmed at what's going on in this country without becoming demoralized, right? Or thinking that there's nothing that can be done about it. You may recall our interview with David Pepper, the former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, around when his book, The Laboratories of Autocracy, came out in late 2021. David came on the show. He offered us a stark warning about the threat posed by state and local governments captured by extremists who then operate somewhat below the radar, thanks in large part to the decline in local media watching them. And at the end of that interview, you may remember that I asked David for some ideas of how, like, decent people could fight back. And now David has a new book on exactly that topic. It's titled Saving Democracy, A User's Manual for Every American. And I'm very happy to be joined now by David Pepper to discuss it. David, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you. And, you know, I'm always trying to strike that balance too, you know, alarmed enough to get to work, but then not so alarmed that people lose hope.
It's very difficult. It's something that I really struggle with. And I think it is easy to become overwhelmed with just the flood of assaults on civil liberties, on, you know, pluralism that we're seeing. As we record this, by the way, your book is the number one new release on Amazon's democracy vertical. It is seven places ahead of Ted Cruz's book, Unwoke. So congrats on that.
Yes. I just moved ahead of Tucker, too. I'm very excited.
So did you decide to write this book because of what we were just talking about, because of like similar concerns Yes. about leaving people with a sense of hopelessness?
You know, I actually heard very explicitly from the same exact feedback. And when you write books, you kind of, you figure out quickly, you better listen to the readers. I heard the same thing said, and it was, your book was really interesting and informative, and I liked it, but it was so dark, I kept feeling like I had to skip to the end to get to solutions so I could keep reading the whole thing. And so basically I heard enough. I thought, you know, people are saying to me, I need a little more hope sprinkled throughout. And so this book is basically skipping to the end. It's saying, okay, we have to be, you know, aware of the problem. If you want every detail of how bad it is, I've written a book for you. It's called Laboratories of Autocracy. But once you're there, and this book summarizes some of that too, once you're there and you need to be there, here are all the things you can do to deal with it in your own personal life, not just hoping that, you know, a senator does it, but you can do. And one of the things I've really come to think is the we have a very narrow federal narrative about democracy that not only is not accurate, but it's also very disempowering because it leaves most people who don't live in a swing state or aren't, you know, or don't you know, work in Washington, feeling like, well, I can't do anything. It's all about some other place that I don't live in. And once you realize, which is what my first book is all about, that no, actually the attack on democracy, the front line of it, is in states all across this country. It's everywhere. The one thing that's good about that, although it's kind of a bleak thing to realize, is there's so much you can do about it right where you are. And the fact that we aren't doing those things where we are is why they use those places to attack democracy. So my second book is all about, once you realize where the attack on democracy is, which is all over the place, there is also so much you can do to take it on that you've never really been told you could do.
Yeah. And I just want to like take a moment to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about before we get to some of these, like how to fight back things. And I'm just going to go over, David, bear with me. I just want to read a couple of headlines in my news feed from today, just from today. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 24th. In the news today is a story about how so-called election integrity groups in Florida killed a provision in an election bill that would have helped protect Florida poll workers from harassment and intimidation. They didn't want that. Also in Florida, Amanda Gorman, who became like a minor star when she recited this beautiful poem at Biden's inauguration, said that her poem has been banned in a Miami-Dade school after a right-wing activist complained. that Texas passed a bill mandating that the Ten Commandments, no, I'm sorry, Texas did fail to pass a bill mandating that the Ten Commandments are prominently displayed in every classroom. But that was mostly because of infighting among Republicans and scheduling issues. They did get a school voucher program that defunds public education, basically. An 18-year-old Nebraska girl and her mother are both facing jail time after the then 17-year-old took abortion pills that her mother had obtained for her. Also in Texas, Republicans passed a series of bills this week that have been described as a, quote, sweeping power grab over elections in the state's most populous and Democratic-leaning county, Harris County, and Harris County alone. South Carolina Senate passed a six-week abortion ban. And this is just headlines that popped up in my newsreader on one day. And every day is something like this. David, do you think the situation has gotten worse since you wrote Laboratories of Autocracy?
Let me just say this. And this is the first, this is the part where I'll sound negative. Yeah, it has. It's, I wish that what I'd written in Laboratories, which was in these unaccountable and rigged states, there is no incentive but to do anything but getting worse. And so, of course, it always gets worse. My biggest frustration hearing all of what you just read, and this is why I, before I get to what every individual can do in my book, I talk about how we have to have a paradigm shift in the entire way we think about the battle for democracy. Almost nothing that the side that cares about democracy is doing or has built an infrastructure to do solves any of what you just described. Any of it. None of it. If all we do is fight for federal seats for Congress and the House and the Senate and even win the presidency, we can win all those things with the current strategy. And almost not a single of the alarming stories you just described will be affected, even if we win that battle. And so once you hear, and that's why I'm routinely every day frustrated. Because to me, once you realize, no, the battle for democracy starts in states. It starts with unaccountable politicians in gerrymandered districts on down doing crazy things for which no one can challenge them. It's going to always get worse. And everything you just described is basically the consequence of what they are, of the system they've set up. And on our side, we literally have no response to any of it except, hey, let's go win elections every 2 years, which doesn't solve that problem. So, yeah, it's getting worse because there's no one putting up any brakes to it. And one of the things I go through in this book, more detail than last book, is once you have systems of no accountability as exists in most of these states, every incentive that we sort of assume leads to good public service actually gets turned upside down. In these unaccountable places, which, again, you mentioned all the states, Ohio, Tennessee, you name it. Once there's no accountability, the incentive to be somewhat mainstream becomes an incentive to be an extremist. The incentive to serve the public who votes for you, once you're guaranteed to get reelected because you don't even face opposition, that incentive to serve the public actually disappears. And your main incentive is to avoid a primary and to keep the fat cats happy because they could knock you out in the primary. So you do the bidding of private players who want part of the public good at the expense of the public good. And then, of course, you always have an incentive to undermine democracy because if you had to have a record as an extremist and as someone doing the private's bidding at the expense of the public, that may work in your gerrymandered system. But if you ever were in a real democracy, you would lose. So once you realize that the incentives actually all work to lead to extremism, of course it's getting worse. And until we decide collectively the problem is a lack of accountability in all these places and start to do things to bring accountability back, there's no reason we should ever expect to get better.
I would just add that once you're insulated from accountability, okay, so you're serving the fat cats on one hand, but it also incentivizes, you mentioned, you know, you're only worried about primaries. That incentivizes this kind of performative
absolutely
wing nuttery, right? Where you're like doing things that are just designed to appeal almost to the right wing media as much as any constituents.
Correct. And here's what you know if you're in that system. And we allow this to happen when we don't run against all these people. And I go through the book how many of these people are uncontested every time. Those Tennessee Republicans in that state house, half of them basically did not have an opponent last November. So in their screwed up world with no accountability, they would be risking their career if they had voted to keep the Tennessee three.
Right.
And they helped themselves in their world of worrying about primaries by expelling them. So the point is, like, we have incentivized all the worst things. And so that's why when you ask that, is it worse? It will always get worse until we start making those individual office holders feel that there's accountability for being as crazy as they are. Right now, they don't feel that at all.
Yeah.
And that's why there are no breaks to it until we do that.
All right, let's talk a little bit about solutions. I know you want people to, of course, read the book, which promises, right, by the way, to be a workable handbook for ordinary people to fight back against autocratic government at the state and local level. But can you give us a sense of what you're proposing kind of in broad strokes?
Sure. So I would say the overarching themes are there's a huge part of the attack on democracy is disenfranchising a certain part of the electorate that is the more diverse and young part that was the heart of the Obama coalition. And so there are a bunch of key planks, and I give ways that everyone can do some of this. But wherever you are in this country, you can play some role in helping re-enfranchise and re-engage parts of the electorate that have been disenfranchised. And that can happen in a red state, in a blue state, and often in these close states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and others. The way that they've helped themselves tremendously is to gut the Obama coalition. So I go through all sorts of ways that in every part of your life, if you at your work, at a nonprofit, at your church, if you go to the same restaurant every week, whatever it is, you could literally use that part of your footprint to engage voters. I'll just give it a couple examples. I go through the book. If you volunteer at a homeless shelter in Ohio, in wherever, there is no reason that a homeless shelter isn't registering every single person that it serves. They just need to do it. And they often aren't. A food bank, a rec center, every mayor in this country, and I don't say this to criticize, I was a council member, I just didn't think it was part of my job. Every mayor of this country, and it's mostly Democrats, it sits on an enormous footprint that could be engaging thousands and thousands of disenfranchised voters who have been specifically targeted because they vote for Democrats. And so, again, every health clinic, every library could be a place to reengage those voters. So there's a whole section of work that could be done by nonprofits, by businesses, by civic leaders to reengage the part of the electorate that's been suppressed intentionally. And you've seen the quotes like I have. They don't even hide what their goal is.
Yes.
It's to make the electorate smaller and to make it older and whiter. They say it. But there's no reason. In fact, it gets my competitive juices flowing. If you're the mayor of a city and you know that they are intentionally suppressing the people of your city, you should feel, a competitive anger to fight back for your people. And so I go through all those steps. So I'll stop because I know you have other questions, but that's one of the big planks is re-engaging the electorate that's been attacked. And there's so many ways you can do that I think for the most part are simply not done because no one really thinks it's part of the roles that they actually are already playing.
There is this mirror image on the right, the so-called precinct strategy that people like right. Stephen Bannon have been pushing for years. First of all, that starts with just running for everything, for every office.
Yes. The second plank. The first is engaging those voters that have been disenfranchised. The second is, and I go through the crisis of it. Do you know the authors of the abortion bans that led to so much consternation and worse in Texas, in Ohio with a 10-year-old rape victim going to Indiana, in Mississippi that led to the Dobbs decision? The three authors of those bills didn't even face an opponent in their next election. They turned all of American politics upside down, and in their own life, they felt zero accountability. Of course they're going to keep doing this stuff. And when you draw the curtain back, that's just 50% of the Tennessee Republicans. In some states, it's more than 50%. In other states, it's millions of people with no choice in these races. We have to run everywhere. Not because we're going to win everywhere.
Right.
But because we'll win in some of those places if we actually run. You never win if you don't run. But even in a losing effort, you're bringing accountability and transparency that otherwise just doesn't exist. Now, this is a big thing to say and harder to do. the reason we're not running everywhere now is there is no infrastructure that values running everywhere. We literally act as if anyone running anywhere that they can't win is somehow a waste of money. Once, and that's because we only think about politics as, are we winning federal swing seats? So it feels like a waste of money running anywhere but that. But once you realize that the extremism is going through a downward spiral, because throughout this country, there's literally an army of elected officials who never face opponents, so who they only act like extremists, you realize that running everywhere is actually the key step to bring accountability back to these places. To go down a level, though, I agree. Steve Bannon is right. Democrats need to have in every corner of every state, people who feel they're not just precinct executives through a title. They own the organizing of their precinct. It's the most, you know, it's the smallest level, the smallest unit of organizing politically. And I'm telling you, having seen it in my own state, and I tried to help with this, but it's true everywhere. If 10% of the official precinct people in the country that are Democrats, if 10% of them take ownership to organize a precinct, I'd be impressed. The number probably isn't that high. This is the most low-hanging fruit in party politics, would be if 50% of the people who are precinct executives spent every 2 years getting to know everyone in their precinct, making sure they welcomed new residents, making sure every apartment building had a captain who was working the halls of the apartment building, registering everybody, it would change outcomes everywhere. So I agree that we have to do what he is saying on his side. We should be filling all these precinct positions. We should be, obviously, as I said, up the level a bit, running everywhere. And that's another big part of the book is showing people how to do that. But absolutely, that should be the baseline default attitude we have.
And I just want to add that there's been a lot of criticism, especially with the rise of Act Blue and this smaller dollar donation machine that it's created. There's been some criticism of like long shot Senate candidates getting millions and millions of dollars running against odious right wingers. And that's taking resources away from other races that are maybe winnable races. I think that we have to also note that when you're talking about investing in state and local races, that is a place where you get a lot of bang for your buck. And, you know, yeah, getting into those races, even if you don't have a great chance of winning, is not the type of thing that drains money away from a larger effort to win Congress or the Senate or stuff like that. Let me ask you this. You've thought a lot about this, this kind of everybody getting out there strategy of running up and down, running for offices up and down the ballot. Are there indirect benefits to doing that? Like, things that help over the long run that may not be apparent during that race?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate this question. The zero-sum view of all these races, I think, is really narrow. It's a really narrow and blinds people to the benefits of running everywhere. And I think, again, a lot of that comes from a sense that, well, the only races that matter are a few swing states. Let me give an example. Did it take away from federal expenditures that people got excited to give to the justice who won the Wisconsin Supreme Court race? No. That was an amazing win. And the dollars that went to that didn't take away from the next Wisconsin federal race. Having that justice in place probably greatly helps us win more congressional seats down the road because it'll end gerrymandering.
Yeah,
that's the same principle everywhere. So the way I look at it, having been a chair of a party, it's hard for me to fault anyone for raising a lot of money. But so if someone, Amy McGrath ran against Mitch McConnell, she raised $100 million. My glass half full view of that race is that, boy, when the grassroots activists on the progressive side think a race really matters, they get really fired up.
Yes.
Really fired up. We have to do a better job of explaining to those grassroots donors that the way to save democracy is not simply beating Mitch McConnell. It's broadening the conversation and battle plan enough so they think, well, you know what? Maybe Amy McGrath gets 70 million or whatever, but the other 30 million, we are smart enough over a big community to figure out if we took that 30 million that would have only been extra TV ads and put it into races that are previously uncontested or underfunded in state house districts, in dozens and dozens of districts, the money would go much further than rounding errors on a TV ad buy, and we'd actually be holding extremists accountable all over the place. So I don't have a problem with running in tough races. What I get worried about is that we kind of get caught up in celebrity U.S. Senate races at the expense of everything else. And again, you know, take some of that away, stick it into, and you know this, like some state rep campaigns, it could be a $50,000 campaign and you are blitzing the entire district.
Yeah.
And you explain that your opponent voted for an abortion ban that sent a 10-year-old rape victim to another state, and no one would have ever known that otherwise. So I think it's about, we should all be thinking about individual and collective sort of our pro-democracy campaign spending. And if we think about it that way, we realize, okay, spend some in a Senate race, some must wins, maybe some reaches, but preserve enough money so that we're building a deeper infrastructure in states to take on this long-term problem of extremists running rampant with no opposition whatsoever. And by the way, so one of the most important things I put in this book is, why are they giving to Amy McGrath to that amount? Because one, they've been told that democracy really matters by beating Mitch McConnell. And two, they know how to give. You get online, you give it to her website. We need to create more mechanisms, and I outline some of them that exist in this book. We need mechanisms that not only say to people, this too helps democracy, but here's an easy and secure way to help that race. And that's why I go through in the book this group called the States Project, where they are getting a whole lot of donors to adopt the state of Michigan state house races or Minnesota. And it worked. And we all of a sudden won races in cycles we normally don't win. We convinced a large group of people, and I was part of some of these meetings, that it was actually a good expenditure to give to a bunch of state rep candidates in Michigan they never heard of. Or in Ohio, I started something called Blue Ohio, where we actually crowdfund money, monthly contributions, and we give them to some of the hardest to run districts in Ohio just to be sure we have candidates in those districts. So we had 1,000 members in only 3 or 4 months. So we have to build up mechanisms that really help move some of the money out to better uses than only being taken up by high profile campaigns.
The last time we spoke, I think we both lamented that, you know, as much as people don't necessarily pay attention to national politics, that's even more of a problem when it comes to state and local politics. And that's a challenge just as far as simple awareness goes. Do you see that changing in the English, how does it work? In the wake of Roe being overturned, and also with these book bans and the like getting more national attention than, let's say, you know, very extreme tax policies might. Are people on our side kind of waking up to the threat?
I think they are. I mean, I think it probably is still, you know, not reached critical. I think it's safe to say it's not reached critical mass.
Yeah.
But you can't look, and this is, you know, this is going back to the very beginning, the awareness, but also the optimism and not being so alarmed we shut down. The wins of 22, the WINS, the wins of 22, of every secretary of state office where election denier was running in a swing state, and those state house wins that were historic and counter-cyclical, showed that enough people are waking up to not only present an infrastructure, but to fund it so that we won things we normally wouldn't be winning in that year. So I think we're seeing that there's actually some momentum to build on, and there's some grassroots infrastructure growing from people who have been very committed to this broader vision of how we protect democracy. And so our goal now, we don't have to reinvent it too much. We have to scale it up. We have to create more awareness. We need more people to agree to, you know, let's adopt the Arizona State House opportunity. Let's not lose Pennsylvania. Let's win Virginia this November, for example. If enough Americans sort of gravitate towards those races that gravitated toward helping Amy McGrath, or that kept Carrie Lake out of being governor of Arizona, or that helped win that Wisconsin Supreme Court race, then we're really starting to get some momentum. So I think it's growing. It's not where it needs to be. It's not the awareness of, let's say, the Koch brothers and the ALEC network. They really get it. But it's growing in a way that I think offers some optimism, and we just got to keep building it. And a lot of my book is about the types of organizations and efforts that we need to keep growing, and that anyone interested could join if they wanted to.
I want to talk about a related challenge, I think. It strikes me that if you look at the rights messaging, it's all designed to keep members of that movement in a kind of perpetual state of dread, of existential fear, right? So although the details differ, there's like a consistency of narrative. You got violent Antifa leftists, you got assaults on Christianity, there's hordes of undocumented immigrants flowing over the border. Transgender people are lurking in women's restrooms. Of course, the whole world is hopelessly woke and relentlessly hostile towards their group, towards their in-group, towards mm-hmm. nice, white, straight Christian folks. It's this consistent storyline that says you're losing your place, you're losing the country that you know and love, and those people want to do you harm. Do you think that there's like an inherent challenge in organizing people around protecting democracy, or even the status quo ante, the pre kind of Trumpian status quo? These are more abstract threats, I guess, or at least they seem more abstract unless you understand how they tend to lead to concrete, like real world harms. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, and this has been a centuries long issue. I mean, I whenever there's been sort of a quote newer looking America that's more diverse, that threatens the old majority, you see a fierce backlash. And obviously it can be very irrational, it can be very, it can bleed into violence, and we've seen that many times. I mean, I often go through the parallel between now and what happened in the South after Reconstruction, when you start to have majority Black state legislatures in the South, that there was a massive and fierce and violent backlash that led to Jim Crow. So the fear of being in the minority is something that is this pattern that has really, on a almost a regular basis, turned politics upside down. And that really began, this is why I'm so insistent, and it's not sort of an academic point, I think it's important to, if we're going to respond correctly, so much of what started the recent attack on democracy was Obama's victory in 2008.
Yes, exactly.
And it wasn't just that Obama was a historic figure, the first Black president. It's that a coalition of diverse Americans, anchored in Black Americans, got its way in an election. And got its way not just to elect Obama, but it turned Ohio blue at every level, basically, except for a rare gerrymandered state Senate. It turned other states blue. And that fear that, oh my gosh, that group, that big coalition is in charge now, is the driving force of so much of what's come since. Voter purging, voter suppression, gerrymandering, far more intense. It's the fear of being in the minority in a diverse America. And the opportunity for us is the group is the majority, and the views of America generally reflects the views of the majority. That's the positive. If we take advantage and see that, we can win. The risk is the fear of a majority being unlike the group that's been in power a long time really does lead to fierce and sometimes violent backlash. And the folks that are leading the far right hate stuff, they understand all this. They're triggering it as much as they can.
Yeah.
But yes, when you start to see, I feel like we're going back and forth between the very alarming and the very positive. When you start to see white supremacist violence show up every few weeks and the nonstop bowling of certain people, yeah, that's reaching a real fever pitch of that sort of strand that's really haunted us for centuries.
Yes, it has. David Pepper, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me. It was obviously, as always, a great conversation. Appreciate your questions and appreciate your highlighting this new book I put out.
Folks, it's called Saving Democracy, A User's Manual for Every American. I recommend that you get yourself a copy and take on a project or two to save this good country's democracy. I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the fine people at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. Oh, God, you can follow me, find me wherever on social media. It's such a mess. Mastodon. And if you're on Blue Sky, check me out there. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Come on.